My name is Mark Asplund, and I will be talking about the relationship between preopposition flight behavior and reproduction in female whitefly parasitoids. And in this work, I've been collaborating with Jesse Harden and David Byrne. I'm no longer in Arizona. I just moved to Minnesota, where it's a lot colder. But this work was done as part of my PhD work in Arizona. So typically, when we think about dispersal in insects, in female insects, we think that dispersal is traditionally viewed as antagonistic to oogenesis. So if you look at this diagram, where you have investment to the ovaries versus investment to the wings of the flight musculature, typically in you can view there are two ways you can view this. The sort of traditional oogenesis flight syndrome idea is that early in life, insects that invest heavily in reproduction and vitellogenesis, so insects that we would consider to have a more pro-ovogenic strategy, like Jay was talking about earlier, tend to invest less in flight, and insects that invest more in a synovogenic strategy, so they have lesser initial investment in reproduction, typically invest more in flight. And in certain anautogenous insects, you actually have a case where there is no reproduction early until after some sort of flight. Then the flight muscles are histolyzed and used to, the proteins are used to produce eggs. But you can also view this within a species in the second diagram, pointer went away, where you can imagine that all things being equal within a species, so body size, age, that egg load in a female may be negatively correlated with her dispersal capability. And so there are a couple reasons why we might expect that. One are allocation trade-offs between the thorax and the abdomen, and also others are that high egg loads may lead to unfavorable wing loading values, so an aerodynamic constraint. But I believe there are multiple reasons to expect we might have an alternative hypothesis for female parasitoids. And there are several reasons why. One is that there's a well-documented trade-off between lifespan and early reproductive effort in parasitoid wasps. So when you have that, you could have a case where the selection could favor a more time-limited dispersal strategy in those parasitoids that have invested heavily early in heavily in early reproduction. So that's one possibility. So there could be selective pressure for this. But also, many parasitoids are of minute body size, and aerodynamic constraints really change when you get to low Reynolds numbers. Wing loading relationships and wing beat frequency relationships break down at this point, and these animals are sort of swimming in the air, so to speak. And then also, from an interspecific perspective, there's a lot of variation in egg size in parasitoids. And this is because endoparasitism frees some parasitoids do not have to provision their eggs with yolk, or a lot of yolk. They can gain nutrients from the internal environment of their host. So we have several reasons to believe we might actually see a reverse relationship in parasitoids, both from the intraspecific and interspecific perspective. And my goal is to have an empirical experiment that might be able to get at these issues. So I chose whitefly parasitoids, and the reason I chose whitefly parasitoids is that they're relatively easy to culture, but also, despite attacking the same host, there is a wide variance in reproductive strategies in this group. So I chose two genera. One is Eretmosceris. They're both in the Aphelinidae. Eretmosceris is best described as a very short-lived, relatively high early reproductive effort. It's got what was referred to a more pro-ovogenic strategy of egg production, typically as a genus, whereas Incarsia, most Incarsia, especially the ones that attack whiteflies, are what we call strongly synovogenic, lower reproductive effort early in life, longer adult lifespan. So what I did is examined the flight behavior of 420 one-day-old naive females with respect to hosts. They were all given ad libitum honey diets over 2 years in a vertical flight chamber, and I'll explain that apparatus in just a sec. And so we looked at five species in these two genera, which have different life history parameters. So this is the vertical flight chamber. It's in David Byrne's lab, and it's modeled after the one created by Kennedy for looking at aphid migratory flight. And the way this works is you have a skylight cue You release the insect. It is positively phototactic, so it moves towards the skylight cue. And then what you do is manually release an airflow through the baffles at the top that creates an equal but opposite force to the vertical ascent of the insect. So essentially what you do is you're conning the insect into flying in space. It's like an insect treadmill. But the great thing about this is it's free flight. This is not tethered. You're actually examining the free flight. There's no worrying about deforming the thorax through a tethering technique. You can also rig this to a vegetative cue, so you can mimic the passing of plant cues to see if this insect is trying to forage on each planet's seas or whether it's in sort of a migratory phase of behavioral flight. And then you can rig an anemometer up to a laptop computer and measure that that rate of vertical climb across the entire duration of the insect's flight. So we measured two parameters of insect flight. The first is propensity, a yes-no simple question. Do they initiate flight or do they not? And so what we did is we gave female parasitoids 3 minutes to engage in flight. 3 minutes was more than enough time for these small parasitoids to go all around their enclosure tube. They would walk around. Sometimes they would walk to the bottom, to the top, but it was definitely not a time-limiting situation where the insects did not have enough time to reach, to have a positive phototactic response. And also what I did is, using light, got all the insects to start at the bottom of the tube, so I didn't bias the experiment where you had some parasitoids having varying positions in the tube. And I didn't include jumps and flights that did not reach the skylight cue, because these were probably not patch-leaving behaviors. So the second parameter is called, I call, effective flight distance. And this is based on a very simple equation, the old standby, distance equals rate times time. What I had was a digital anemometer that could record the per second vertical climb of each parasitoid. So I could just sum those over the entire duration of the flight and get how far that parasitoid would have flown if I hadn't constrained it in the chamber. And so a simple diagram of this would be adding a 3 second flight where you add those rate of climbs and you would get a 1 meter flight for that parasitoid. So here are the propensity data for the five species I looked at. EN is Encarsia, ER is Eretmosteris. And just looking at these data, you can see, okay, there seems to be a pretty substantial difference between the two genera. But there's a problem with looking at these as independent data points. Encarsia and Eretmosteris are both monophyletic genera, so you can imagine that these reproductive strategies are common to the genus as a whole, that Encarsia is not free to vary within it. Same with Eretmosteris. So what we need to do is correct for potential phylogenetic pseudo-replication. So what I did was a heterogeneity chi-square test to see if we could lump all of the Encarsia together and all of the Eretmosteris together, because those are really the evolutionary units. And for Encarsia, that seems to work. You can lump the Encarsia together. Heterogeneity chi-square is not significant. It's very not significant. So Encarsia seems to, as a group, have a homogeneous propensity strategy. Unfortunately, Eretmosteris does not. The Neuroemeritus species has a much higher flight propensity than the Eremicus species. So what we did was compare Eretmosteris to Eremicus, and you can see that's significant, and Eretmosteris to Neuroemeritus independently, you get the same results. So there seems to be an indication that the two genera differ in their propensity strategy, at least within 3 minutes at 1 day of age. We also looked at the potential for egg load to affect flight propensity in these species. So we didn't have enough replicates for Encarsia formosa. They just were relatively poor flyers. But for the other four species, we did look, and no significant difference in either. So egg load is not a good predictor of flight propensity in these species. And this is after consideration with hind tibial length as well. So we controlled for parasitoid body size. So we also wanted to see within a species if the effective flight distance was related to egg load. And so what we found, interestingly enough, is we had two trials of Eretmosteris eremicus. It was the only species we had enough individuals to look at. And if you look at the figure on the right, you have a nice negative relationship between egg load and flight, if EFD, which you might expect under an oogenesis flight syndrome idea, an antagonistic relationship. But interestingly enough, in the first trial, we didn't see that. Now, I want to caution you that one of these things is not like the others. We had an outlier. We called her Amelia. because she really flew a long time and had a very high egg load. So this is a positive relationship with the outlier. If you exclude it, it's a no relationship at all. But what's interesting is it appears that there's lability in the relationship between egg load and effective flight distance. So how might this be explained? Well, we measured a lot of different parameters during the course of the study, and interestingly found that the first trial and the second trial differed significantly in adult lifespan, where the second trial, the one that showed the negative relationship, had a longer lifespan than the one in the first section. So there may be a physiological state consideration. But also we had other differences, such as flight chamber temperature and flight chamber relative humidity. This chamber is far too large to put in a temperature-controlled room. So it's possible that two things could be explaining this, either the internal states of the parasitoids, if that changes, possibly due to laboratory selection in this case, or phenotypic plasticity, where differing environmental conditions change the relationship between reproduction and dispersal. Notice they did not significantly differ in flight distance, although that's including an outlier, egg load, hind tibia length, or forewing area. So they seem similar in many other ways. I'm almost finished. Okay, so to conclude, female Eretmosteris within 3 minutes seemed to show a greater flight propensity. That's supporting our hypothesis, our initial hypothesis, that there may be differences in parasitoids compared to other insects. Egg load is not a good predictor of flight propensity in any of the observed species, and it appears that there's some lability and context dependence in the relationship between egg load and effective flight distance in Eretmosteris oremicus. I'd be happy to take any questions we have time for. Yes?
I wonder whether you consider the possible effects of the length of time these things have been held in the rear.
Yes.
Artificially. I mean, Formosa has been,
yes,
for many, many years, whereas Emeratus is probably the most recently,
yes,
domesticated. So.
Yes, we did look at that. That was a definite consideration, because one would expect that laboratory selection may decrease your propensity to fly. So in the two youngest colonies, which were a field-caught Incarcia sophia and a field-caught Eretmosteris neuromoeris, you saw the exact same relationship. So I don't think this is due to necessarily to laboratory selection.